Welcome to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamic. With Balsamic mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcast the easy way at simplecast.fm. This podcast features Mike Davidson, former Vice President of Design at Twitter and current long-term sabbaticalist, and his fireside chat from August 10th, 2017.
We are about to start our kind of last talk of the day,
which is a fireside chat, minus the fire, because it's summer in Chicago. And really, fires in Chicago don't really have a good, you know, long-term reputation, relationship, etc. Good. With me this afternoon is Mike Davidson, former VP of Design at Twitter. Is that correct?
It is, Russ.
And current long-term sabbatical-er?
Yes.
I'm a year and a half into an indefinite vacation right now. So this is about as close to work as I've come in about a year and a half.
All right. So before we dive in too deep, by the way, this is open forum. I'm going to ask Mike questions, but if you've got burning questions, let us know, and we'll try not to hit you in the noggin with that. But I have a few questions. The first is, Mike, so what, lots of stock options? How can you afford to do this whole sabbatical thing?
Well, let me first say, I haven't taken more than 2 weeks off in my life until this. So I was never a big vacation taker. I would take about 2 weeks off a year. Didn't really take a break between jobs. I always kind of like hopped on the next train. And kind of towards the end of Twitter, you know, it was about 3.25 years, very high stress. The subject of Lisa's talk was managing chaos. That was basically my job description for my entire 3 years there. So towards the end, I said to myself, you know, when I finally decide to leave, I'm going to let some trains go by. And I committed to taking at least a year off, if not more. And yeah, I mean, I did okay at Twitter. And I also sold a company before that. So got a little bit of a cushion to take some time off.
Thanks. I have purposefully not asked you that for the last 24 hours, so I could ask you that now. And so now something that's a little near to me, not anything that's happened to me. However, the internet is an interesting place. What with the tweet stormings and the Medium articles, those were air quotes because I'm not sure that they're actual. Anyway, so people who work for other people and they leave places that they've worked. So, for example, let's say all of us are leaders at an organization, and somebody leaves and writes about an experience that was not too non-positive. Yeah. These leaders, managers, etc., can't really do anything about it. How do you suggest people deal, cope, handle with something like that? Since, you know, I think you've kind of been in some situations where...
So you're saying when somebody leaves your company and writes a very candid article or a candid series of tweets about what it was like to work there.
My manager was shit.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay. Very candid.
Or bad things happened while I was there. And I'm not... Yeah. Listen, none of this is to single out any of those folks. It's just my experience is the people who work in the human, not the humane, resources really don't want, or even the legal department, don't want you as a manager to respond or say anything, and you can get in more trouble for responding to somebody and engaging than you can by saying nothing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good one. I've been on both sides of that, actually, because when I did leave Twitter, I wrote probably 10,000-word article about my time there. And not just at Twitter, but in San Francisco as well, because, you know, a lot of my experience was, you know, what's it like being somebody who's not from San Francisco, going down there and working at a crazy tech company for 3 years. And I was as candid as I could have been, but I was also very professional about it. Because, you know, my goal is to be helpful with everything that I do. And so if I'm going to criticize the company or the city or anybody that I worked with, I want to do it like in a forward-looking way that's helpful for the company. So like before I publish that piece, I reread it. I usually don't reread anything that I write. I just like, first draft, boom, published, done, whatever. I don't even go back and read it, like, you know, the next day or the year after.
Article.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But this one, like this particular one, though, I probably went back and read like 20 times because I wanted to make sure that where I was critical, I was being positive. I think I hit the right notes, but if you were at the company with me at the time, there are certain paragraphs you could read and you'd say, I know what he really meant by that. Like, I was in that meeting and it was not that positive. Or I know exactly who he's talking about, you know, that sort of stuff. So I think, like, as an employee leaving a company like that, I think it is your duty to at least try and be helpful with your criticism. Like, it doesn't do any good to kind of throw people under the bus without, you know, trying to make things better. As somebody who's still at the company trying to deal with something like that, like, I tend to try to do these things in private more often. I think Twitter, for all of its its positive attributes, I think it's a very poor place to have real discussions sometimes that involve nuance. And I think oftentimes when people are going back and forth on Twitter discussing a topic, perhaps even a sensitive one like that, it becomes more of a performance because they're performing in front of their followers and the other person is performing in front of their followers. And you end up saying things to each other that you wouldn't have said face to face. And so, you know, oftentimes if I kind of see that happening in advance, whether it's like a tweet where I think it's going to turn into something more or an article or whatever, I'll reach out to that person in private and say, hey, what did you mean by this? Like, can we talk about that? So I like to handle as much of it in private as possible. And then, you know, ideally the best case scenario is the person actually writes a follow-up, which kind of like captures more of what you wish the first one kind of captured.
Gotcha. And so, I mean... That's great, and I think you're suggesting to folks, an employee leaves your company that worked for you and says a bunch of bad things, best to reach out to the individual.
Just sue them, either way.
I have three words for everybody, professional liability insurance, particularly if you choose to sue other people.
I've never sued anybody.
Good. All right, I'll take a quick check of the audience. Any real questions for Mike? They're all real questions. Any questions for Mike before I dive into the ones that we've thought of beforehand? Okay, Mike, what do you wish new design leaders today would focus on?
I think that a lot of times when designers go into the field, they feel like it's a field they can do on their own in front of their computer. And I know that was one of the first things that drew me to design is I saw all the things that I could do myself in front of a computer in Photoshop, and I felt powerful. I worked for my college's newspaper, and I was designing, you know, newsprint ads for sporting events like football games and basketball games, and I literally just sat in front of Photoshop and, you know, designed an ad for a football game that was going to go on Saturday, and I would take it down to the college newspaper, and they would put on the press, and it would go to the press, and like it was really just me. It was my work. Like, I didn't have anybody proof it. I just kind of like just did it all myself. And I figured, like, wow, what a great field to get into. Like, I have so much influence over this product that I'm developing. And only when I got into the real world of product development did I realize how much of a team sport it is. To do anything really, really great in the world requires the collaboration of engineers, designers, researchers, PMs, marketers, execs, like a bunch of different people. And so like a large part of your job as a designer and as a design manager is learning the skills to collaborate with the other people who can actually create all this good stuff with you. So, you know, it's very common to bring inexperienced designers into your organization and see them immediately kind of go off into the corner and try to like impress you with the work that comes off their computer screen, and like that's impressive and stuff, but it's not impressive when it actually then goes to other departments. And you know, maybe you take it into product, and product's like, well, why do you have a designer off in the corner like building this thing? Like, there's no spec for this. This isn't in our plan. We don't want this. This doesn't fit into the product. And they're right. You know, they're right because that designer was not actually talking to the people that they're working with to produce this thing. So, you know, a concentration on people skills. Some people call them soft skills. I don't think that's right. Like, it's just like people skills. It's just communication. It's just being a nice person, collaborating. These are skills that I don't think are taught very well in design school or in college, or certainly not in front of your computer screen.
I've seen a lot of design school thinking and focus on critique, the crit. Being kind of hard ass, toughening you up for feedback. And that feels a little at odds with something that you just said, which is teaching collaboration. Mm-hmm. Meaning, like, why does critique have to be, why do you have to have a tough skin to be a collaborator? Why can't you just be open with each other? How do we help people get past that kind of hardness of critique and that, I don't know, not necessarily softness, but more fluidity, I guess, of collaboration?
Yeah, well, I mean, critique and collaboration, I think, are separate but related topics. Like, critique is like, here's the thing I did, now I would like your opinion on it. Collaboration is, hey, what should we build? What problem are we trying to solve? That's getting everybody in the room at the beginning, getting everybody bought into the concept, and then deciding to move forward. So, like, they're related skills. I think they both could use some toughening, for sure. Like, the first time that you get criticized, like, as a designer, not even the first time, like the thousandth time you get criticized as a designer, is a blow to your ego, right? Because, you know, you think you've created something great, and, you know, as soon as it hits the battlefield, whether it's like a professor in school or whether it's like a bunch of A/B tests that turned out, you know, your design was crap. It does take a thick skin to kind of get over that and, you know, get past your own ego and realize that your role as a designer is not to please yourself. It's to create things that you know, influence human behavior.
One of the things that I found that's been hard for me has been like going through a retro or something and somebody stating something or hearing some research that was opposite of my view and then celebrating it with the team. Oh, wow, that everything I thought was a complete opposite of that. This is awesome. Let's go figure out what to build, right? Yeah. Now let's do the next thing that's better. Like, my idea was horseshit. This is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I forgot who said it, but, like, you either win or you learn. That was
my shirt.
Like you?
No, that was my last shirt.
Oh, that was your last shirt. Oh, okay. Maybe I'm just...
Somebody,
were you wearing that last night?
No, like 10 minutes ago.
Oh, okay.
Well, somebody just now figured it out that he's been changing shirts for every talk.
Wow. It's working. Subliminally, I'm thinking of this, of your shirt now.
Yeah, that was a shirt for Lisa's talk.
Okay, but it's great. Like, it's a great philosophy to have, you know? It's you're either right about your idea or you learn why you're not and you move forward. Like, there's no reason to be dissatisfied. I will say this, though. A behavior that I've witnessed in large contentious organizations, I won't, you know, name any in particular, one thing I've seen is a team will get together and decide, like, here's the problem we want to solve, here's the approach we're going to take, and they'll go over all the risks to that approach, and they'll say, hey, there's a 25% chance this is going to work, but if it works, like, it's going to transform our business or whatever, and then it doesn't work, and then there's a bunch of, like, revisionist history that goes on after that. And people start asking, well, who greenlit this? Like, why did we let this team go off and do this project? Didn't work. Clearly it was the wrong thing to do. 25%, those aren't good odds. And, like, you know, you have to be not only tolerant of like those sorts of risks in an organization, but you have to encourage those sorts of risks. Like, Jeff Bezos is famous for saying, like, I want Amazon to be the best company in the world to fail at. And like, I think it's a really brilliant kind of philosophy to have. Like, he wants so much innovation to go on in that company that failures occur all the time. Like, he was even famous for saying, like, you think the Fire Phone was a big disaster. You haven't seen anything yet, you know? And I love that philosophy. Like, as long as you can learn from your, you know, quote-unquote failures, you're getting better as an organization.
Awesome. Questions? Oh, they're going to make me do all the work. All right.
I see a big list down there. We can just go through that.
I mean, we're going to. They're in tiers as you decided which were the best here. So I'm going to go to the next one, which really ladders off of talking about collaboration and even critique. In order to help people collaborate, it's, you know, common goals are needed. And you get those when you're working on a project. Here's the end thing we're trying to do. We agree on that. What about, though, as you establish a design team and what the design team wants to be when it grows up? You know, how do you go about setting those goals, you know, giving your team that charter to how to operate so that we're not just the graphics group?
Right. Yeah, the art team.
Creatives.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. And, like, my answer to that is, like, I think design teams really need to have two sets of goals. You know, when I took over at Twitter, the team was, like, less than 20 people. They all sat in a room together. By the time I left, it was, like, 100 people. All spread out through the organization, and we had, you know, really two sets of goals. One of them were actual design goals, and I think one of my mistakes early on is, you know, one of the first things I did when I got there, as I said, we need to come up with some design principles. And so we took the entire team, And it was a very collaborative process, and we came up with like 8 design principles that we really, really believed in, we thought could, you know, move the product forward. Examples were like every pixel counts, understand the problem first, relentless refinement, things like that. And they were a great rallying cry for our team, but when you're in the trenches building a product and like an engineer is telling you they want to do something that goes against the like every pixel counts design goal, that's not a really good way to argue for what you're trying to do. Like you can't necessarily expect an engineer or a PM to care about design goals that are geared towards designers. And so for that reason, I don't think design goals are actually the most important part of the goals that you need to set for your design group. I think those goals are operational goals. So your design goals should be something like, we are going to have all of our files under source control in the next 6 months. We are going to redo the way we do crit into this, this, and this. We are like internal stuff, like you know, design department matters. Like those are your kind of design goals. But your most important goals, which are, you know, are going to be a lot more important than those, are really just company-wide goals, product development goals. Like if you cannot come up with goals that you share between engineering, design, product, and research, you're doomed to fail. So I guess my advice is to think of those as two separate processes, like company, like department business and company business.
So going off of that a bit too, you had the title of VP of design. How many people are on that team?
About 100. It was like 65 designers, 35 researchers, and then, you know, mixed in there 10, you know.
Mark Trammell was on that team,
right? Pushers like me.
Mark Trammell was on that team?
Mark Trammell was on that. Mark Trammell was, I believe, the first researcher on the Twitter design.
So that's more like 45. Mark is like 10 researchers.
He is. Mark is a 10X.
If you don't know who Mark Trammell is, he's done some really amazing stuff and is the most unassuming man on the face of the earth.
It's true. His beard is about 10 times bigger than mine, though.
It is not. He trimmed it.
Oh, he did.
It's red, though. Yeah. And he's a very distinct individual. I digress. I think the largest team I've led was 45. Mm-hmm. And in fact, something that Jesse James Garrett told me a few years ago when I was getting into leading larger teams was that the thing that I had trouble with was, I'm going to lose my pencil skills. I'm going to lose my OmniGraffle skills. I'm going to lose my research skills. I'm scared to leave design to take on this new thing, which, to my credit, I think is really kind of smart that I recognize that leadership is a different set of skills. What Jesse pointed out to me was it's not you're leaving design behind. You're taking design somewhere else where we need more of it, which really helped frame it for me. And even though I've done that and I've seen myself as designing design teams and forming that, the thing that I've struggled with is that I don't see design anymore. Yeah. How did you see design? Did you see design with 100+ people at Twitter? How do you manage becoming, you know, gaining these new skills and trying to shape the design versus leaving that to someone, hiring well or putting people well into place to do that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. Like I will say, you know, at some point in your career, you should kind of decide whether you even want to be a manager or not, right? Like, I think one of my favorite rules we had at Twitter, which I will definitely carry through to the next organization I'm in, is there are separate parallel tracks for individual contributors and managers, and they both get paid the same and they both rank the same. So, like, there is no promotion into management. Like, if you are a senior designer and you want to be a manager on my team, it is a lateral move. We will try you out with a small team of like 2 or 3 designers, and you will not get a raise, and you will not get any sort of like bump in anything else. Like you've just decided to move sideways, to stop working on product problems and to start working on people problems. So I think it's healthy to, you know, if you think you want to kind of get into that, it's healthy to kind of give it a try with a small team, see if you like it. Some people eject right away. They're like, whoa, I had to do three one-on-ones this week. I'm not into it. Oh, we're talking about salaries. I'm not into that either, but let me go back. Some people really embrace it, you know? And so I think, you know, if you're interested in trying something like that out, I like, you know, try it at a small size first. But the second part of your question is, is it important to keep your skills sharp? And I would say yes, absolutely. Like, there were department-wide exercises we did, like blue sky redesigns of Twitter, a design language refresh, component library updates, and I personally participated in all of them, in Illustrator, in Sketch, in some cases pushing code, learning learning jQuery, which I didn't really know by the time I got there. So like I'm far enough, even me, like I'm far enough removed from being an individual contributor that I know I'm never going to do that again in my life, but I still want to be current on those sorts of technologies and how people are designing. I feel like the best managers and leaders in design are practitioners as well. It doesn't mean they can continue to be the best individual practitioners for the rest of their lives, but they know what goes into it. So when a designer comes to you and says, hey, I don't want to do 20 mocks for this thing, I can empathize with that because I've done 20 mocks before. The designer says, hey, I just spent 3 days wrangling jQuery to do this like animation that you asked for, and like this extra thing that you just asked for is going to take me like another week, and you just wasted a bunch of my work. Like, I want to know what that means. Like, and conversely, I want to know when I can call bullshit too, because there are a lot of times when a designer, an engineer, PM will come to you with something and say like, hey, this thing that you asked for is like a lot of work for us, and then you can just turn around and go, interesting, because it's not a lot of work for me. So I think it's not about keeping your skills as sharp as they've ever been, but it's about kind of keeping them as sharp as they need to be.
I agree with that, and I'm sorry that I asked you about 20 questions there. So one of the next ones was, though, and I'll give you a little bit of I guess, something for this. How much design at Twitter went out the door without you approving it?
A lot. Oh, I have a good story about this, actually. So right when I got there... There was this thing called product review, and it was every week, and it was Dick was there, our CEO, Adam Messenger, our CTO, and like a couple other people now, and me, and that was it. And a different product team would come in every week to pitch what they had been working on and show their prototype, and we would discuss it for an hour. It was great. It was just like deep, like super deep product talk, like design critique, everything all mixed in one. It was great. And so I'd done like a couple of these. I've only been there like a few weeks or whatever. And I thought I had a good hold over like everything my team was doing. And then one week, the events team came in, and the designer on the events team, her name is Jana, she's great. She came in and showed this thing I'd never seen before. And it was like a new take on how to do live events on Twitter. And like she started presenting, and I just heart went into my throat, and I was just thinking to myself, I have never seen this thing before, and it's being presented in front of the CEO and other important people, and I just kind of kept my mouth shut and I let her go through the presentation, and then like Dick turns to me and he's like, what do you think of this? And I like totally faked my way through it. I almost felt like blindsided by it a little bit, like, because how dare this person on my team present work to like the CEO that like I hadn't even seen before. So I got through the meeting okay, and everything went fine. But I pulled Jana aside afterward, and our CTO, who knew about it as well, afterwards, and I said, I don't ever want to be in that situation again. Like, I got to see this stuff before it gets presented to the top. And they were both kind of like, huh, okay. because there's so much going on. It's weird. Like every time there's a change at Twitter, like this latest redesign, that went out a month and a half, 2 months ago, or whatever. There were some
the rounded stuff.
Yeah, rounded avatars and like all the other cool stuff.
That pissed off a lot of people. Circles.
Everything
are just
pisses
really,
off.
Right? Circles are the worst.
Yeah, but so
until we bring back squares.
Yeah, but some of the comments were interesting. Like there were some of the comments were like, I can't believe you would waste time on something like this, when you can't even handle this or whatever. And it's like these people think that it's a single-threaded organization where like it's like a kid's soccer team, where the ball goes over there and then like everybody runs over there, and then the ball goes over there and like everybody runs over there, and like when you have 2,000 engineers and like 65 designers and 35 researchers and like 100 plus PMs or whatever, like everybody is working on different things at all times. So you're going to miss stuff. People say, I don't know the name of the principle. There's a principle that says a company tends to look like its product.
Jared, do you know? A company tends to look like its product. Do you know the principle?
And a product tends to look like its company.
Oh, Conway's Law.
There you go. Conway's Law. Right. And it's totally true with Twitter, right? Like, it's a little, it's pretty chaotic. You miss a lot of stuff. It's kind of all over the place. It's really fast, but it's really cool. So like learning to deal with that sort of chaos and learning to kind of trust your team to produce things that your eyes haven't necessarily been on is a new skill.
My favorite quote to people, and some of them here have heard this, is I hate surprises. Please don't.
I hate surprise parties. that sorry. Just thought I'd throw that in.
Tonight's gonna suck for you.
Damn.
All right, so you're still at Twitter. Humor me for a minute. You're still at Twitter. You got 100 people. You just hired a brand new design manager. Mm-hmm. You know, and they have 6-7 people that they're responsible for. You know, what kind of expectations do you put upon them? What you know, how do you onboard them? Frankly, I think as an industry, technology sucks at onboarding people to anything. So how do you do that so it doesn't?
Yeah, so the company has something called NHO, New Hire Orientation, where like all the new hires for the week like go into this room and like they spend the whole day like getting pitches from every department around the company, and Dick comes in, tells a few jokes, and like it's really cool. But none of it is really specific to design, and so we kind of designed our own NHO. And so when you come onto our team, you get a very design-oriented version of that, whether you're an IC or a manager. But like to answer your specific question about managers, I kind of think of manager progression as in terms of like how much influence do you have inside the org and at the company. And so as a design manager one, like a new design manager, I don't really expect you to have any influence outside your own team. Like all I expect you to do is basically manage the 3 to 6 people that are on your team, do one-on-ones every week, look over their work, help them improve, look after their career, you know, the typical kind of, you know, manager stuff. Then when you get to senior manager, that's more of like a full team where you're kind of like 10 to 12 people, but seeing like general responsibilities, but you start to have a little bit more influence across the design studio. When you get into like the kind of director levels, that's when I ask every single person who either wants to be a director or currently is a director, like you need to pick something extracurricular to do that improves the entire design studio. So examples of this are one of my directors, Mike Krasniski, led the design component library refresh across Twitter. So we componentized all of our symbols, and that was just a project without any schedule. It was just like this needs to be done, and it needs like a pretty senior person kind of leading it. So he took that on. Another person organized the kind of yearbook for the end of the year, where we had this beautiful like leather bound yearbook of the design team and, you know, the offsites that we had done, the work that we had done, a bunch of fun stuff. Like she kind of put that all together. So that's kind of what I expect at the director level, is sort of like a studio wide influence. And then at the senior director level, it's more like company wide influence. It's like how can you affect teams outside of design.
Would you at some point draw that into a funky thing and write a Medium article about it? That could be very useful.
Yeah, I could.
You're saying is no, not going to happen anytime soon?
Maybe during Hack Week.
Maybe. How about...
That was always our answer. Somebody had a really good... somebody had an idea that you didn't want to do. Like, hey, you should do it during Hack Week. Never get done.
So at your surprise party tonight?
Yeah. Okay. No, that's not a bad idea, though. I have written a lot about how we evaluate designers. Actually, it's one of the things I feel... It's a lot that I wish would have gone differently in terms of, you know, how the product developed and a bunch of stuff. But like, you know, one of the things that I am kind of most proud of is the career ladder that we put together. Most companies have very general career ladders that are like, here's what a VP does and here's what a director does. And like, you kind of try to map what your life looks like in that ladder, and it's kind of hard to fit. So we came up with a framework that we created with the entire team. So this was like revision after revision after revision, using input from everybody across the entire team. And we basically came up with 4 things that we kind of evaluate people on. So if you want like a raise, a promotion, anything, like there are 4 ways that we grade you on that. And I think it worked out really well. Number 1 is getting things done. So do you do what you say you're going to do? When you commit to doing something, are you putting time in when you need to get that work done? Are you dependable? Number two is building relationships. So, you know, are you the sort of designer that your engineers and PMs like fight to work with again? Like, if I tell somebody like, hey, I may need to take this person off this project, do they fight to keep you? Also, are your relationships within the design team strong? Are you helping other people? Number three is improving the team. This is one that can be expressed in a number of ways. It can be expressed in terms of like recruiting. Are you helping bring people into the company? It can be, are you holding brown bags to like do skill shares? Maybe you're really great at prototyping. Are you coming in and teaching the rest of the team prototyping? And then the fourth is kind of like the individual skills, technical skills, empathy, and vision. So by spreading, the criteria across those four kind of pillars, we've de-emphasized, you know, being a great designer, and we've emphasized being a great teammate, because that's kind of those are the sorts of people that we really wanted to build.
Thank you. I see we've got about 9 minutes left, so I'm going to turn this into a lightning round. So okay. If y'all have questions, raise hands, and I'm here. Ready? I remind you, it's soft.
You didn't call bank shot.
Dive for that. Sorry.
So while we're in lightning round, ask your question, and we got a minute, and I'm just going to keep us moving. We can pass that thing around. All right.
What's it like designing something that people actually use to give you feedback on it? Like, they don't actually have to go to your website to give you feedback. They're on the thing.
Yeah. It's great and it's terrible. Oh my God. Yeah. No, the latest post I wrote actually was specifically about that. Actually, if you go to mikeindustries.com, I think it's the last post on there, but yeah, it's really, really tough. Because, you know, for a lot of reasons. Number one, like, it's really hard to say anything really insightful and helpful in 140 characters. It just is, you know? And I feel like getting back to the kind of performance art, like, piece of it, I think there are a lot of people out there who, like, love looking at updates of Twitter or anything else and coming up with the tweet that will get them the most likes or the most retweets or the tweet that will make other designers go, ha ha, that person's a good designer, or that person's really insightful. And like, that's not really what the goal of critique should be, or of feedback. The goal of critique and feedback should be helping like improve the product that you love. And so the downside of getting feedback over Twitter is there's so much of it, and a lot of it is like fairly low quality. But the upside of it is like, how amazing is it to work on a product that people like care enough about to actually give you direct feedback on like that? So you just got to kind of like, you know, go through and sort of categorize like, oh, this was like super insightful, we should totally do this. And then like, we'll do this stuff during Hack Week. and then like, this is just stuff we should just ignore because it's not constructive at all.
Stop. Behind you, and oh, all right. You could have went way back there. Go back to Ryan. Come on, you can do it. Come on, Brad. Brad, you're losing your volunteer stripes. Come on.
Ooh, right. Yeah. Two hands. Thanks. Nice haircut, by the way.
me or him?
Russ. Okay. Yes. I know Russ. I don't know this gentleman. When you're at a company like Twitter, right? Yeah. That is publicly traded, and you're moving at a lightning speed. Can you talk about some of the, as best you can legally, the constraints that you were put on top to produce stuff at a rate that maybe seemed nuts?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's tough because you are accountable for your quarterly numbers, right? Like people look at that stuff as an indication as to what how the company is doing. And you know, as you all know from being designers and researchers, like not everything that you do is going to show an effect within 3 months of time. So, and in fact, you may decide to do things that do the opposite, right? So, you've got a great idea for
that's it, Mike.
That's it. Sorry.
No, you can't.
You get a great idea for a feature and it tests really well, but like it doesn't improve immediate engagement. That's not getting people to like, you know, pull the slot machine more, but it is making people happier. And you know, do you have the wherewithal, not just as a designer, but can you get that buy-in all the way from the top that, hey, this is a good thing for our product long term? And so I will say, you know, Jack, who's the CEO now, has been a really great influence in that regard. Like he's very patient with that stuff. And one of the smart things he did when he took over is he said, hey, there's some changes that we have to make to this product, and they're gonna take time. And you're not necessarily gonna see the results like immediately in our quarterly earnings, but you'll see them eventually. So you're right. It's a lot of pressure, but it also shouldn't be used as an excuse for, you know, doing things that you shouldn't be doing.
Another question? Oh, now I think they're just taunting us.
So you kind of touched a minute ago on some of the good things that might take a long time to come out of this. And one of the problems we're having at my company right now that we all acknowledge is, like, when something fails, we don't do a good job of revisiting it. It seems really hard because you have these, like, quarterly goals to hit, and then you got to figure out why did that fail, and that's really confusing too. So I'm just wondering if you have anything you want to say about how to manage that. Like, when something does fail, how do you evaluate, like, is it worth spending more time on?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I keep coming back to this concept of decision quality. And it's different than outcome quality. And like when you say something failed, that's an outcome. And you can say the outcome of this decision was bad, but you can't necessarily say the quality of the decision was bad. I'm going to use a really, like, personally painful example here that I've used before, but it's relevant. I'm a Seahawks fan. Seahawks, Bears, we get along, right? But everybody remembers the Super Bowl that we lost against the Patriots a couple years ago. And, you know, we threw the ball at the 1 yard line.
Does everybody really remember that?
Everybody.
Just Seahawks fans.
Everybody in Seattle remembers it. Everybody in New England remembers it. We had the ball at the 1 yard line, basically. You know, all we had to do was run the ball down the middle. That was the idea. And we win the game, win the Super Bowl. We throw it instead. It gets intercepted. Everybody, including me, was livid about it. Like, how could we possibly do this? Like, what a terrible decision. Worst decision in the history of sports. And, like, that's... A lot of people still think that. A lot of people still think it is. But if you actually dig into the numbers, like, the amount of times that a ball was thrown from the 1 yard line that year and there was a turnover was lower than the amount of times there was a turnover if the ball was run. So there was more fumbles from the 1 yard line than there were interceptions. And there were a lot of other ancillary stats that made, like, that play call actually be, like, pretty reasonable. And so you got to, like, when something like that happens, you have to go back and look, like, what was the quality of our decision? Like, was there any information that we should have had ahead of time? Was there any research that we could have done ahead of time to prevent us from going down the road? Or do we actually make the right decision? And, like, I know, you know, the concept of chance is a stretchy one, but, like, was it really just something, like, you know, like, kind of chance that caused it to sort of not work out? So I think you have to be really, really religious about that, not just with your failures, but also with your victories, because the same thing can happen, right? You can make a low quality decision that turns out really well.
Carmen has a question over there. If you've got the catch box, gently don't hit her.
So,
remember,
I just
she
wanted
worked
to comment
for the CIA.
On that last point on the chance on the Seattle play, because what's interesting is ESPN did a documentary on Bill Belichick and how he trained the New England Patriots. I don't know if you saw it, for that
game. Particular play. Yeah.
And that was the last play in the walkthroughs the night before in the ballroom of the hotel they're staying. The play he walked through was what if they throw at the 1 yard line.
Not so, just what if they throw, what if they throw the slant.
It was the, like, slant, the exact exactly. Yeah. And so we know, just to... on the point on chance, that it wasn't chance, that there was actually a causality, that he somehow anticipated that that was a play Seattle could run.
Right, but
just
what
neither
other...
here nor there.
No,
but
it's
I,
true.
I just thought I would share that.
Yeah,
no,
it's
you
totally
already
true, but,
knew
what,
it.
But what other plays did he plan for as well?
Yes, exactly.
What the hell is happening?
Eli, I'd love to get your question. However,
into a football conference.
We're at time, and I'm gonna take the opportunity to ask the last one myself.
Yeah.
You worked for an organization where, in some cases, people depended upon it. I think some cases, people still depend on it to get their message out. And I'm curious, this is to help myself and a few others. I work for an organization that is our United States federal government. And a lot of people really depend upon the United States federal government for its service, too. Yet at the same time, an awful lot of people have pretty strong feelings about anything happening with the organization, yours or mine. How do you help a design team stay positive in light of, you know, sometimes no matter what they do, it's not good enough or it's not good or worse?
Are you talking about the question didn't end the way I thought it would. Are you talking about how do you get, like, if you're a designer on a team that is being used, that designs a product that's being used by people that may harm the world?
It truly depends upon who's using it, for one. But no, I think in organizations where sometimes, and I think I asked it poorly, in organizations where sometimes no matter what happens, the organization gets dumped on. How do you help a design team stay positive in light of that, that the work that they're doing matters, that they're still doing things to affect change, that even though they made rounded corners when there are other things that haven't been resolved yet, that it's not a single-threaded organization. How do you help people stay positive knowing that what they do matters?
Yeah. I think you just answered your own question. I think the answer is you are lucky enough to work on a product that people care enough to even crap on. You could be working on a product that, like, nobody even cared if it was well-designed or if it was poorly designed. They just use it. They just use it, and they hate it, and they go home, and that's it. And you'll never find out what people think about it at all. Like, that's not cool. That's not fun. But, like, to work on a product that people, like, love or depend on enough to where they actually feel passionate enough to, like, give you feedback on it, as tough as that feedback might be sometimes, is a blessing. And you have to separate the words from the kind of, like, motivation and the intention behind the words, which is usually not to harm you, although I will say... Designers at Twitter have received death threats for things as simple as the retweet. Remember when that was controversial? But even that person, I would say, didn't really want death to occur. They were just very frustrated that this product that they love had changed. And so I think that's kind of the way to turn it around, is to say, like, how lucky am I to work on a product that people are passionate enough about to actually care about?
That's awesome. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, everybody, for sticking around with us today. Sure.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamiq. With Balsamiq mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcasts the easy way at simplecast.fm. Learn more about Chicago Camps events on our website at chicagocamps.org.